Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your host, David Swinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us an awesome 5-star review and follow us on Twitter at SerengetiSec.
Guess I should do something with that Twitter account every now and then.
It could be useful.
I guess. We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application that you can take into the office to help you protect your organization.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
They say if you thump the side of your threat detection, you can determine whether it's still ripe.
Or you could smell it.
Has to have that lovely floral scent.
Yeah, it's too definitely sweet. Right.
It's too sweet. It's overripe. It's gone too far. So, Title One. I'm jumping in here. I don't know if you wanted to take Title One or not, but I'm seizing it and shaking it like a baby. What's happening in the world of personal cyber insurance? This comes to us from Malwarebytes. I guess this isn't really a surprise. Personal cyber insurance. This is actually a summary of an article from the Economic Times of India. I am a little disappointed with how often this happens, that so much of the news we see is just like a summary of a news article from somewhere else. I think it's my personal belief that if you took a survey of how much of the news is just a summary of the news from somewhere else, easily 75% of what's being passed off of as news is just somebody rewriting somebody else's news. And that makes me sad.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about it before, but I think you're right.
Yeah. It's just content summaries upon content summaries and top 10 lists of content summaries.
Yeah, it's almost like if you had a podcast that was talking about something else somebody else did.
Oh my God, how are you calling this out?
And summarizing that.
Oh boy. Oh boy. I'm feeling very picked on right now. I don't know why. All right, so first discussion points. Some folks think that the mere presence, this is quote, some folks think the mere presence of insurance simply encourages more attacks and is hurting more than it's helping.
I know there's a case to be made for that, I suppose, but this kind of reminds me of car accident scams, you know, where someone pulls in front of someone else and stops and then they get rear-ended and they do that as part of an insurance scam. You know, does the fact that that car owner had insurance and, you know, is that enticing the person to pull in front of them and stop short? You know, I wouldn't necessarily say that's true. It's just they're taking advantage of the situation.
And I definitely find it interesting that they did specifically call out in the article that some of the insurance policies will pay out for ransomware. So I do feel like paying out for ransomware will certainly encourage more ransomware.
Yeah, we talked about this before where insurance companies are starting to drop that or add that as an additional rider or extra cost if you want to have that ransomware, you know, be able to pay for ransomware. But I would say this is really only in as far as the possibility where you're going to get attacked if you have it just based on the fact that you have insurance is probably only in the ransomware arena.
That's fair. I'm still a believer that nobody should be paying for ransomware, period. And I know this is a thorny area, especially when it comes to laws, but this is one of the few places where I think that maybe an argument could be made that it should be illegal to pay out for ransomware. Maybe.
Well, I don't disagree that the fact that people are willing to pay fail, you know, is an incentive for more ransomware to take place. But every individual or every organization should be allowed to make their own decisions about what they're going to do and what they're not going to do with their money based on the situation they're in.
Yeah. Typical, you know, libertarian response, right?
I mean, obviously we'd be better if everyone uniformly said we will not pay ransom.
Yep.
You know, if that you could guarantee that across the board, ransom would probably pretty much dry up.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing with bribery, right? Same thing with most crime. And yet,
right. Yeah.
Weirdly enough, it still exists. That is so strange. Ah, damn it. You got me. You talked me out of it, right? Because we've outlawed bribery everywhere and that didn't stop it. God damn it.
Well, I'll write that down.
Well, so I find it kind of interesting that the premiums are based on how much you have to lose, which of course makes sense. What I find interesting though is really for cyber insurance, the premiums really should be based on how stupid you are. how likely you
take
are.
Take an IQ test.
Well, I mean, really, like, yeah, it's how much you have to lose is a big part of it too. But there's lots of people who never click on, you know, phishing emails. And as we've seen with phishing tests, there are lots of people who click on every single phishing email they receive.
Oh, you know what? That would be interesting then if, let's say you sign up for your premium, right? Or you sign up for this insurance contract, but part of the contract states that the insurance company is going to test you for phishing.
Ooh.
And based on your test responses to them conducting those phishing trainings against you, is a variable for your policy premiums.
Because that's even better than what I was thinking. I was actually thinking about what we were talking about the other day, about how Daniel Meisler was talking about how governments were eventually going to just insert themselves into the networks of critical infrastructure companies and just monitor the companies directly, which we'll talk about later. And that insurance companies would start doing the same things with individuals. Like they'd put a little black box for you to hook into your home router and just kind of monitor your home network like they do your car. But they could also do something like that, right? Where they could run, you know, breach and attack simulation style stuff or phishing simulations against you and then use that to score you and then turn around and that would feed your premium cost.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking that insurance companies could be offering a lot more services than outside of insurance, but related to organizations to help them be better.
Yeah.
Because it also would end up reducing their costs. Because if they offered phishing training and attack simulation, you know, with the policy. And maybe, I think we also talked about this before, where they'd have an IR team that's part of the retainer that would, you know, come out and respond. You know, so I think there are a lot of opportunities within the insurance space to do better, to help organizations do better by offering these kinds of related services.
Yeah, especially like on the IR front, to make sure it's done right too and help protect the company going forward. Because we've both been on IRs in the past where the IR team comes in, they do the containment or whatever, and the team, the leadership team is just like, let's get this done. We just want to get back to business ASAP. Whereas an insurance company IR team is more like, no, let's do this right. Let's get to root cause. Let's figure out how they got in. Let's get the vulnerability or the whatever the opening was sewed up and corrected.
Right. And shading that in a positive or negative light doesn't help them either way.
Yeah.
You know, so they want it to come out as accurately as possible as to what truly occurred.
Yeah. Because their goal is to prevent it from happening the next time, to save the insurance company money the next time. It already happened this time.
Yeah. And not only next time for that organization, though, but next time for all their other policyholders too.
Because then they can end up with like a Verizon-like report, but with more detail that they can pass on to the other companies that insurance companies protecting.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that would be something else that would be part of your premium, is the service to get that data.
Yeah.
You know, so that would also push the insurance company into like a threat intel type organization also.
And get it faster. You don't have to wait till the end of the year. Like you can be getting stuff very quickly.
Yeah, I need to go to a Prudential or something and pitch this and say, I'll stand up this whole thing for you. As Matt was alluding to, the premiums, at least based on what we read in the two articles or the summary and the other article, was that the policy seemed to be very customized. You know, they have to sit down with you and go over all the things to see.
Which is very, you know, very difficult. That's difficult to generalize. So this seems like the very early stages. They're still trying to figure out kind of what policies, because, you know, that's not ready for the big time until they've got, you know, standardized policies to roll out to everybody.
Right. Because it's going to be a lot of, you know, context-based questions and stuff like that, to have the nuance there for
it. Can you imagine too, like, how much do you have in cryptocurrency? Oh, $2 billion in Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah, that'd be nice. But anyway, so some of the things that they are say that they will ensure are costs against invasions of privacy, fraud, restoration of servers, of systems, That includes replace or repair of damaged devices, data recovery, and in some instances, obviously these are will differ based on the carrier, but and monitoring of customer data for data breaches.
Yeah, is that the same monitoring customer data for data breaches? Is that the same as identity protection is now? Watching for like social security numbers and stuff online.
Well, if you mean like monitoring that, I think it's like dark web monitoring, I think.
Ooh, I haven't really paid much attention to what that
was. I don't think it's like, you know, identity protection services or whatever you get every time your data is breached.
Gotcha.
I mean, I'd rather they gave me a dollar every time instead. I mean, better off. Right. But some of the article from the Indian news source was pretty interested in some of the things that they had in here for what they protect against: cyber stalking or bullying, cyber extortion, and media liability claims. This is interesting. It said, covers defense costs and third-party claims due to defamation or invasion of privacy due to insured's publication or broadcasting of any digital media content. There's hacked social media accounts, unauthorized online transactions, which I think is like account takeover for your bank account. Of course, data breach and privacy. And what was also interesting in the Indian article is they said that covers expenses to the prosecution of the bad guys for all of these items that we just listed.
Which is interesting, given that you were talking about like a lot of what you heard recently, that a lot of bad guys don't get prosecuted unless they cross a certain threshold that's fairly high.
Right. Well, this is also in India, which...
Oh, fair enough.
Because in the United States, let's say if any one of these things was actually a criminal action, you would not have to pay for prosecution in the United States of that person.
Yeah.
Right. Hmm. But you would have to pay if you want to sue them to get something out of them. And I don't know if that's what they're considering here when they say prosecution, but that doesn't make sense that it would be that way. And so I'm not sure exactly the way the Indian court system works, but if you have to pay for whoever wrongs you to go to jail on top of your taxes, which pay for them to be in jail. Well, I guess technically everyone is paying in the United States, but that would be nice. They could say, well, we're going to pay your tax burden then because your taxes cover all these things.
Yeah. I don't know. So I just checked in a lot of the identity theft stuff in the US do dark web monitoring for if your identity is involved in a breach. So.
Okay. So the same kind of thing.
Yep. Yeah.
But items that they specifically said they would not cover, a second ago, that all these policies are going to differ based on the carrier. But one of the articles said that items not covered would be cryptocurrency.
Son of a.
Yep. So there goes your wallet problem. Gambling. Fraudulent conduct.
I mean, I can't lie about it? Damn.
Yeah, I guess not. Unauthorized collection of data.
See, that one's kind of weird, though, because is not a data breach unauthorized collection of data?
It is, and that's what got me thinking about maybe this is more along the lines of like what Facebook does. Yeah. You know, they collect a whole bunch of data that maybe you didn't authorize in their privacy statement or something like that.
Or that you just didn't read, and then later you're like, wait a second. Maybe. I think actually what happened with Facebook, right, was where they had an API where someone could vacuum it up. It wasn't really a data breach. Like, nobody broke in. They just let somebody have it.
Oh, so maybe what they're talking about is like the Clearview. It's not necessarily Facebook, but Clearview's access to your Facebook data.
Yeah. Yeah. Like scraping Twitter API stuff or stuff like that.
Yeah. I don't know. And then there's accessing restricted sites. I'm not sure exactly what the heck that meant. They wouldn't cover.
Maybe it's when you right click and select view source, like that governor from Missouri said, that's hacking.
Anything's possible.
Anything's possible. Like, hold on. I'm going to hack this site right now.
No, Matt, don't do it.
Don't do it. No.
I'm glad I got that in a recording now. So if they come after me as an accomplice, I can say, I tried to stop.
So I don't understand this. Yeah, yeah. The refuse from working from home, the next one. If you work from home, are you not covered in anything? Are you only not covered in the hours that you're working from home?
I'm not sure. Because I was But my question about this was, is this saying that if you have a home business where you work from home, they won't cover it?
That makes more sense.
Because this is personal, you know, personal protection. So I'm not sure, you know, if you're a self-employed or something, they're saying, well, we're not going to cover any losses that you suffer because, or maybe it's along the lines of, let's say you lose wages because your internet's out, something like that. You could go to the insurance company and say, hey, my internet was out, so I lost a day's worth of wages, and file a suit or a claim against those wages, maybe.
Yeah.
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
And as far as the insurance carriers go, they either seem to offer these as an add-on to existing insurance policies or as completely separate policies, depending on the carrier.
Sure. Yeah, I don't understand how they're able to tell. So some of these, it's pretty easy to tell if it's covered or not covered. Like if you submit a loss for, and they're like, how much was it? And you're like, $45,000. And they're like, all right, how do you know it's $45,000? You're like, well, that was the value of one Bitcoin in December 2021. They're like, well, cryptocurrency is not covered. That part's easy. But how do they know about like the fraudulent conduct? Or how do they know like the working from home part versus not working from home part? If it was done via like a phish or something like that.
I have no idea. I assume it would have to be part of the claims process where you describe what happened. Yeah. And either they believe you or don't. So, you know, it's something else that they'll have to have with this kind of policy, which I don't think is necessarily they have to have too much as far as when you're insuring businesses, is investigators. Because once you start offering personal insurance, whether it's for anything, there's a possibility for individual fraud to take place for those claims. So they're going to have to probably start hiring cybersecurity and insurance investigators for claims of these kinds, I would think.
Yeah. Yep.
Of course, why you should even be interested in this is that, you know, if you're doing anything on your personal computer at home where you could potentially experience a loss, like accessing your bank from your computer, then you may want to consider whether you're going to get personal cybersecurity insurance.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Bank is my only real fear because I feel like bank is the only one where they can transfer money out and you cannot get it back. Like credit cards, generally speaking, there's some protection there.
Well, there's also, you know, brokerage accounts or retirement accounts. You know, things, anything in that kind of realm also is something to consider.
I just don't click on links for anything related to my bank or my brokerage accounts. And I have two-factor turned on for all of them. And I have all of them bookmarked. And that's the only way I ever access those accounts.
Yeah. Well, I've often thought it'd be a good idea to have like a Chromebook, that any financial stuff you just do on your Chromebook, and that's the only place you do any financial stuff.
I actually did that for about 5 years, and then I ended up quitting because it was kind of a pain to do. But yeah.
Well, there's always the trade-off.
Yeah.
I know years ago, I was reading a Bruce Schneier article, and he was saying he did not do online banking, period. And this was, I think, if I recall when I read that article, it's about 10 years ago or so. I don't know if he's changed his mind since then.
Yeah, well, back when we worked together, I did not do online banking. I think I started doing online banking about halfway, about 7 years ago. And I used a Chromebook for about 4 years. And then once my bank started offering two-factor, then I started doing it with my bank online. Once I started doing two-factor.
Mm-hmm.
So that was when, and again, like I said, I never click on anything. I go straight to the bank always. I have two-factor turned on everywhere. And then every time it asks me, it's like, do you want to recognize this computer? I always say no.
Yeah, so, that's a double-edged sword, the recognize your computer thing.
Then somebody could do a SIM swap and intercept it. Well, I guess they could do that either way. So,
no, it's what you're talking about as far as the, do you or know this computer or whatever. That's part of what's the term I'm looking for? Not benchmarking, but fingerprinting.
Yeah,
that some companies would do to recognize that computer has been seen before that you've logged in correctly from, and that can add to the validation. So it's a double-edged sword as far as whether it makes sense to do that or not. Because I'm considering, what I'm concerned about is if my computer's compromised.
Yeah, it's got a back door on it, then they can just log right in.
Yep. Yeah, it's not really helping. So 50, 6 in 1 hand, half dozen the other, as far as whether that's a good idea or not, I think.
Yep. Yeah. No, but you're right. If you screw that up, you could lose a lot of money real fast, potentially. Of course, that's assuming you have a lot of money.
Yeah. So I'm not worried.
Oh boy.
All right. Of course, what you should do about this is buy it right now.
And even with that other article that we didn't cover with the help desk, if there's a poor help desk procedure, although are they obligated to refund the money or refill your account if they screw up the help desk part, or are they just so sorry?
I don't know. That's a good question. Cause I think it'll come down to, who can prove fault. Cause if you can prove that they were at fault, you certainly could get a lawyer. But if they emptied out your bank account and your bank account only had $5,000 on it, you're going to spend $5,000 waiting in the lawyer's waiting room.
Yeah.
Before you even get to trial. So,
all right.
But there'll be a link in the show notes to a Forbes article that has a whole list of insurers that offer this personal insurance if you're interested.
Yeah, maybe I should look into it. That's depressing. Just what I need is yet another kind of insurance to pay.
Yeah, maybe you can get a discount because you're a cybersecurity professional.
Probably charge me more. This idiot's going to do this on purpose. So, in some late breaking news, last night I was surfing the internet, as one is wont to do on Friday nights, and I saw this article about India to require cybersecurity incident reporting within 6 hours off of bleeping computer, and my jaw just dropped.
I know, that should be 3 hours.
6 hours, that is crazy. This is from bleepingcomputer.com. Summary, quick summary, India CERT has issued new directives. Among them, a requirement to report incidents within 6 hours. It is to be enforced within 60 days. It is Section 70B of the Information Technology Act. It is part of Indian law.
Right. When I first read this, I was like, oh, well, there you go, the CERT, making arbitrary things again. And then reading further down, it found this is the law. This is not regulation in that, there's actually the full weight of the government behind it,
So it says that the Information Technology Act was in 2000. So has this been just hanging out for 22 years and they finally enforced it? Or
no, it's an amendment or change or whatever to the Section 70B. I don't remember exactly specific phrasing they use in the article for it.
Oh, I see. Integrated into Section 70B. Gotcha. All right. So it is fortunately not for everybody. On my first read, I thought it was for everybody and I was about to have a heart attack, but it is only for internet service providers, intermediaries, whoever that is, data centers, government organizations.
And it also mentions that this applies to incidents reported to these entities by third parties. And I'm not sure, and they say in the article that servers should ensure incoming tips aren't lost or ignored, but timely processed and evaluated.
Oh, man, can you imagine? So that means they've got to have 24-hour people sitting there waiting for stuff to be reported to them so they can turn around and report it up within 6 hours.
Well, this also means they're going to have to come up with a completely different process procedures also. Well, at least the ISPs will, for their help desk, because they're going to have customers calling up the help desk and saying, hey, I'm having this problem. If it sounds like an incident, then they are going to be apparently under some kind of obligation to
hold on. Hold on. No, that's not quite that bad, because this is the same thing that I ended up. I made that mistake myself where you think that at least for GDPR, the clock does not start until it's officially declared an incident, which is a legal declaration, which kind of goes back to that article we talked about a while ago where lawyers should be in charge of IR.
Well, this is completely different though, because they're talking about scanning as one of the things that has to be reported.
Yeah. And you don't necessarily need a lawyer to declare that scanning has occurred.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. There are certain things where there is a factual, this did happen, versus this has reached a threshold. Yeah, I don't know.
Right. So getting into the list of what has to be reported. So the list of who has to report, pretty small.
Oh, that third party may be pretty broad, but yeah.
Yeah, depending on how that's enforced and what they define as intermediaries, which was really wasn't clear. I assume what they're talking about is something like Coinbase or someone who acts on your behalf.
Maybe.
To do something online. So that's a little bit of speculation there. But the list of things that you have to report is huge and crazy. Like the first thing we mentioned, scanning. You know, if you're scanned, everybody gets scanned all the time, every day.
Yep.
Constantly. And if you have to report the scanning, you're reporting a whole bunch of stuff.
Does it have to report like every IP? Like is every IP a new report? Are they allowed to aggregate it and report like every 6 hours, just send a spreadsheet of IP addresses?
Well, you have to determine what your definition of a scan is, I guess. Because what I was thinking was, how many people are monitoring for scans today?
No, just drop that shit.
You know, everybody just drops it, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you don't have it, are you then required to create alerts to identify it now?
Yeah, what's your threshold? Like one IP hits 10 systems, hits 20 systems, sends, you know, makes 20 connections to different ports, makes 10 connections to different ports. Yeah.
Man, it hits two IPs and then stops, and then hits two more. I mean, this is insane. I mean, no one monitors for scanning anymore. I remember when I was working at the Army cert, you know, 20 years ago, scanning was an incident type, which we did report on occasion. And now the concept of reporting that is just ludicrous.
Yeah. Yeah. The only scanning we pay attention to is internal. And that's like the very lowest, like we only use it for informational. Like we don't react to it. We just notice it occasionally if it gets particularly bad.
Right. And I mean, so if you're going to do this, if you're going to be responsible for this, you're probably just going to set up your alerts and send them straight to the government.
Have it auto fill out whatever information they need and just kick it off.
Right.
I wonder how long it's going to take before they remove this. They're going to wish this was a regulation so they could more easily remove it.
Yeah. And because what I would do is it would just bypass the SOC altogether.
Yep.
Because I don't want my SOC personnel taking up the time worrying about scanning. Just send those alerts straight to government with what they want. If you had to do that instead, waste your time.
Yep.
All right. Some of the other stuff, phishing, unauthorized access to social media accounts, which I guess is like account compromise or account takeovers, unauthorized access to IT systems or data. So more compromised account stuff.
Which happens incredibly frequently for anybody that doesn't have a multi-factor auth enabled. So lots more reports. The phishing one, again, the phishing one you mentioned, it didn't say successful phishing. It just said phishing.
Yep. Yeah. And if you have like a email gateway that's doing that identification also, does that mean that your email gateway automatically blocks phishing attempts? You have to say, that was a phishing attempt, and that goes in the log too. I mean, this is just crazy.
Yep. This was written by somebody who had no idea what they were doing.
You know, that's what I was thinking too, but it's coming from the cert. How can the cert? I mean, maybe it's just I should know better because they are government employees, but I was like, well, when I first started perusing this until I just glanced over the fact that the cert had done, I was like, this is someone who doesn't talk to the cert, just came up with this idea. But no, it came out of the cert, which is, it's mind-boggling. All right, so going back further down the list, attacks on wireless networks, attacks on basically anything that uses electricity, really, is on the list. So this comes down to, what's the definition of an attack? You know, how do you define an attack? Or is code red or NIMDA scanning that's still going on the internet today, is that a scan? Or is that an attack?
¿Por qué no las dos?
I mean, it's ridiculous. If someone uses, what's that scanner for the S? Shodan.
Yeah.
Right. So is every Shodan scan that takes place on the internet, you know, is that going to be an attack or Maybe. Is that a scan?
Why not?
Because also you got to think, when you're talking about like Shodan type stuff, you got researchers and, you know, other cybersecurity folks that are using that platform to find out just what the state of the internet looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get down to even more nebulous stuff beyond, you know, the attack, but suspicious activity affecting cloud computing. It's like, holy cow, that could be huge. And then there's suspicious activity affecting system servers or networks. System servers, networks, software, or applications relating to, and then we get into the next list, big data, blockchain, virtual assets, virtual asset exchanges, custodian wallets, robotics, 3 and 4D printing, additive manufacturing, and drones.
That's interesting. This is a very interesting list.
Because who defines suspicious activity? I mean, it's bad enough trying to define what an attack is, and now you're supposed to define what suspicious activity is. You know, if a SOC 1 gets his hackles up and thinks, this is weird, you know, is that suspicious activity now?
It's all suspicious to a SOC 1, though, so.
Yeah. I mean, just this requirement alone could take up the full time of the SOC itself. I'm not talking about an analyst. I'm talking the full SOC. This could be all they do is deal with this reporting, depending on how the enforcement is for this. I mean, if India wants to be a real hard ass on this, this could take a whole team of people just to do this reporting.
Well, yeah.
You know, as I was second and saying a second ago, I would think that the CERT would have had more sense than to let something like this go through. You know, they would have gotten this more under control. Because imagine, you know, this is a small list of organizations that are affected today. But what if they decide to change that in the future and say, okay, well, we've piloted it now with these groups or whatever. Now we're going to expand this out to companies over a certain size or they have a certain number of customers or something like that. This could completely get out of control, even more so than it is now.
I mean, I have to imagine that this is going to get big enough that this is going to stop. I can't imagine that this is going to get bigger, like that they're going to get so much stuff that I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe you're right. Maybe they'll, I don't know. Maybe this is all part of a scam to get them to hire 10 times as many SOC analysts.
Nope. You know what I think this is? You know, do I think lobbied for this probably?
MSSPs?
Oh. Data centers. Like, you guys need to store all this stuff. So now we got to build another data center to store all this information that you guys are going to collect.
Yeah. Either that or it was one of the famous MSSPs or something. They're like, no, you're going to need a whole bunch more SOC analysts. So yeah, because you were talking, I don't think we got to this yet, but this also requires that all system logs must be maintained for a rolling 180 days and provided to the CERT with any incident reports or when requested. So you can't just submit we got scanned. Here's the scan. You've also got to submit the logs. And also, I assume that the law probably has more details than all system logs, because that is super broad. Or maybe they're going to, this is just published yesterday. There's a press release. The press release directions are issued here. Directions are under sub. Oh my God, I have to click through like 10 things.
Yeah, but if they are limiting the logs to 180 days, that's exactly what companies are going to start storing, because that's what they're required to store now. Because they certainly don't want anything to go over 181 days or anything beyond that, because that's just going to add additional work for it. So yeah, that's what their cutoff day is going to be. And according to IBM, the average day to detect a data breach is 287 days. So by the time they eventually detect that data breach, the actual root cause or how they got in or the details behind the initial stages of that data breach are going to be completely lost.
Yeah. So I went in and I found the directions. The directions just says, shall mandatorily enable logs for all their ICT systems and maintain them securely for a rolling period of 180 days. That's it. There's no information on which logs. So maybe there's something coming up later, but they only have 60 days to implement this. They don't have much time to give them more information.
You could figure, what fields, you know, or what, you know, yeah.
Default logs.
This is just terrible.
Yeah, this is really poorly done.
But additionally to all this, VPN providers are required to maintain records of users during the entire period that they're customers and 5 years after they cease being customers, which includes the IP addresses which they connected to the VPN from.
Yep. Yeah, but they have to keep the validated names of subscribers. They have to keep the period of the time that you paid for it, the IPs used, the email address, the purpose for which they hired the services, the validated address and contact numbers, all the information about them. This is weirdly just kind of tagged onto this law. I guess they were just like, we just want to do this anyway, so we'll just throw this on.
Yeah, and that's probably something they added on top of what the cert was asking for with all those other stuff.
Same thing with the virtual asset service providers, which includes exchanges and wallet management services. They must also do the same thing as part of Know Your Customer laws and records of financial transactions for a period of at least 5 years to ensure cybersecurity in the area of payments and financial markets while protecting their data, fundamental rights, and economic freedom.
Fundamental rights, quoted. Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, very boy. Narrow.
Fundamental rights.
Yeah, but one of the other reasons I think this is going to be that India is going to be a hard ass on us is the fact that this also requires all entities mentioned above will be required to connect to the NTP server of the National Informatics Center or that of the National Physical Laboratory and synchronize their system clocks with them. And the reason that they would want to do this is to ensure that those logs and the times in those are exactly what they say they are and they aren't off so that they can fudge their 6 hour window.
I mean, yeah. And it's annoying that they're, of course, making you, you know, connect. But honestly, like everybody should be connecting to NTP anyways. And there's nothing more annoying coming from somebody who's done IR for years. There's nothing more annoying than logs not matching up on time.
Yeah, I completely agree. And most organizations that they've got listed here are probably connected to an NTP server. But yeah. This is eliminating the wiggle room to say, the clock time is off or whatever.
Everybody sets their clocks like 6 hours behind so that they've got 12 hours now.
Connect to the NTP server on the other side of the international dateline.
6 hours is now 30. Nice.
Like, oops.
We didn't know.
Complete accident. Yeah. Plausible deniability.
Yep. So why does this matter? Well, a big part of this for me is how serious do we really want government to get about security? It seems like every time people aren't serious about stuff, there's this general clamor to get the government involved. And every time we get the government involved, the question is, do they do anything? And if they do anything, are they going to do it? Or are they just going to make us do it via extra laws and extra regulations? So, and do we really want them to do it? I'm usually a big fan. Actually, really, the reason that I'm so big on the insurance market doing this is because the insurance market doing this, that's a market. Like, that's a financial incentive for companies to get serious about security, not the government stepping in and forcing you to. So I like that.
Yeah, personally. The incentives are properly aligned.
Yeah.
So this whole thing is going to have obviously a huge impact just for privacy alone because of the VPN and crypto requirements within here. And what I would expect is that the VPN, the good VPN providers that don't do any logging, they're simply not going to participate in the Indian market. So you're going to get the good VPN providers that go out. You're going to get the fly by nights or the guys who are already selling your data showing up as the VPN providers.
Anyway. I'm actually curious about that. It says data centers, virtual private server providers, cloud service and VPN shall be required to register the following accurate information. Doesn't say about anything about whether they have to be located in India or not, but you're right. It's probably anybody that does business in India, not necessarily ones that are located in India. That's rough.
Yeah. So you can imagine that some VPN providers that like are part of the App Store in, you know, for Apple or with Google Play Store or whatever, those VPNs will probably be banned or blocked in India or something like that, I would guess, if they want to use that as an enforcement mechanism. But the reason we should also be worried about this is this always starts somewhere, you know, so this is pretty onerous. It's starting in India. You can expect that to come to the United States eventually. I mean, we already have the Cyber Incident Reporting for Critical Infrastructure Act, which was just signed last month. And right now that is 72 hours and 24 hours for ransom payments. So you can expect that since we have this, this is already a mechanism in place. So the United States is probably going to increase the kinds of incidents that must be reported and decrease that timeline in the future. Because there's a small number of covered incidents in the United States law, but a huge list of covered entities. So it's like the reverse of what India's got there. So you can imagine those things are going to come together in the future. And with the US law, the way that the United States implements laws is ultimately, this is require the DHS CISA to spell out various requirements via what they call rulemaking. And the DHS CISA director must issue a notice of proposed rulemaking within 24 months. So I would say that what we're looking at today for the Cybersecurity Act might be even different within 2 years based on whatever this rulemaking comes out to be that DHS is going to come up with. And this is just kind of like what happened with COVID. So when COVID happened, China locked people in their houses, welded their doors shut and everything. And the US followed suit right behind it. And I think they followed suit because they saw that what China did and that it could be, you could use fear in order to get away with that. Because even in the Event 201, which was the 2019 pandemic tabletop exercise, they recommended against lockdown. And to quote from the recommendations from that Event 201, travel and trade are essential to the global, national, and local economies. And they should be maintained even in the face of a pandemic. Fear and uncertainty experienced during past outbreaks sometimes led to unjustified closure of customer-facing businesses. So just 3 years ago, or actually the previous year, because, you know, COVID happened in 2020, you know, and I think the Event 201 was in October. So really only a few months beforehand, the US government had recommended against lockdowns. And yet when China locked down, the United States followed suit right afterwards, doing the exact same thing, which was recommended against it, even by their own tabletop exercise. So my question would be, you know, what the hell is the purpose of all this data collection effort? You know, what is the Indian government going to do with all these events, logs, and things that are going to be shipped over there? They aren't going to be doing anything really to further protect those organizations. Were they make some reports or bar charts out of this data? I don't know. It just doesn't make any sense to me about, this is just a matter of control. It's not a matter about actually doing anything to help improve the security of the organizations.
Well, I bet I know what they're going to do with those VPN bits and pieces.
Oh, well, that is one thing. We certainly know exactly what they're going to do with that, yeah, which is why you might as well not even bother using the VPN in India after this.
Yeah. Well, and then for the cyber current, for the cryptocurrency stuff, they're probably going to use that trying to enforce taxes. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, in the name of the ransomware cruise is what that's going to be about.
Yeah. Oh man. Can you imagine? I wonder how many of those people are going to be dumb enough to actually like put their names on those wallets. Like they're sitting there, they've got like $100 million in the wallet. And they're like, do they know it's us? Do we claim that it's us? Or do they, they've got to be smart enough to transfer it.
Well, you and I both know, Matt, that all the ransomware people are Russians. So I don't know, you know, this is really not going to affect them at all.
That's fair.
So, right. So what you can do about this is not much if you're in India. You know, avoid intermediaries, whatever, you know, those turn out to be. Don't use the online cryptocurrency exchanges like Coinbase or anything like that. And don't report anything to any of these covered organizations because that report's going to go to the government.
Seems good.
Well, not really, but no.
Well, that's fair.
But that's it for today. Thanks, everybody, for joining. And follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.